Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids Podcast, where we explore what connects us all in our yoga practice and in our lives. This is where I talk to people about their stories, who they are, what they've been through, and where they're going. And in this podcast, that's what we explore. I believe deep down inside, we're all connected, which explains why we bring ourselves to the top of our mat every day. Welcome to the Heartbreak Kids. So welcome to the next edition of the Heartbreak Kids. I'm here with Sarah Intonato, and I met her in Mysore, India, just like a lot of the guests that have come on to the Heartbreak Kids. And we got to know each other. I traveled to New York. I did a workshop, and I really got to know her there a lot more. And then over the past few years, we've just been able to kind of form a pretty cool relationship. I really like watching all the things that you're doing, Sarah. So I want to thank you for being on the show, and I can't wait to hear your story.
Thank you so much for having me, Taylor. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the backstory. I always like to start there. So, you know, who is Sarah?
Well, I can trace.
Deep question, like, right?
Yeah. Oh gosh, how much time have you got? I can trace my sort of calling to yoga back to my childhood. I was always a well-liked kid, but somewhere within myself, I felt like I didn't belong. Even though I had friends and I had good relationships, I always felt a little bit different, but I could never really nail it down and figure out why. And it was also pretty apparent to everyone that I was a very high achieving kid. I put a lot of pressure on myself to do well in school, to get the lead part in the school play, you know, all those things, even as a really young kid. And, you know, we've both studied quite a bit into yoga philosophy, and we know this concept of samskaras as being a very real one. And I look back to my childhood and I can see all of this so clearly. Like, there are just patterns that I've always had, and I can't blame my parents for them. I can't blame my sibling for them. It's just how I was. And so
it's just so much easier to blame someone else, right?
So much easier to blame someone else. Until you realize your life's not getting any better from doing that. So I really felt a lot of pressure on the inside.
Why did you put the pressure on yourself?
You know, I think I've spent many years trying to figure that out. I think if I had to really boil it down, I would say I either didn't know how to love myself and felt like I had to always be more, better, faster in order to, quote, be good enough, end quote. Or maybe I was afraid that people wouldn't love me if I wasn't more, better, faster, all of those things. I think the pressure has to be linked to something like that. I have since, as an adult who's done a lot of healing work, taken all kinds of personality tests like the Myers-Briggs, the Colby-A, the Enneagram, you know, to try and figure out what makes me tick. And I'm an Enneagram type 1. Which is the perfectionist. And it's so interesting how that's just how I was always wired. And
I could have totally guessed that, by the way.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what I am?
On the Enneagram?
Yeah. Are you good at this or no?
A little bit. Are you a 2?
No, I'm an 8.
Oh, that was my second guess. My husband's an 8.
I'm the infamous 8.
You're the infamous 8. I'm married to one of those.
Yeah, we're pain in the asses. That's what we are.
Fun. And I love how you're the boss and you know it. I love that about 8.
Except for me and my wife. She's the boss.
Well, we know that.
I'm good at that. So you've done this healing work, but I mean, and you know, you've kind of come to understand yourself a little bit more, but I mean, is that still there?
I joke that I'm a recovered perfectionist. If I were not doing my practices, you bet it would still be there. It's beneath the surface. It's managed really well because of the tools that I have that you and I use every single day. But if I decided to take a vacation from those tools, I'm sure all these patterns would come right back. And that's why people ask, you know, how are you so disciplined, Sarah, in your practice? You've got two kids, you've got a special needs kid, you run your own business. How are you so disciplined? And you and I have talked about the fact that we're disciplined because this is our medicine.
Right.
And that's why I'm disciplined. Some people wake up in the morning, they take their medicine. This is my medicine. And it makes it easy for me to be disciplined.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like if I don't take the medicine, if I don't do my practice, like I feel like that there's always a point in time where there's some sort of negative patterns. But I guess my question to you is, like, did you experience like pain and suffering as a result of like trying to be a perfectionist? Because some of what you're describing is someone who is like me, like someone who is an addict, someone who has struggled with an eating disorder, or someone who has struggled with like alcoholism. Like those are the kind of things that we do to put on like this facade.
Yes.
And I don't really know a lot of your story. And so, I mean, was there any of those things that were present that made you put up that front?
Yes. I started in competitive sports really young. And for me, competitive sports looked like ballet dancing and figure skating. And both of those carried a lot of images around what you're supposed to look like, what you're supposed to be. And so by age 13, I was in a full-blown eating disorder, which in hindsight is almost like a slow form of suicide, right? Like it's totally. A lack of love for yourself, a lack of connection to your deeper being. And it's really just such a deep hatred of who you are, where you are in this moment, that you're willing to do anything to change it into what you think will be better. And so by age 13, I was starting to grapple with that. And by age 14, it was really nasty. I was in a really intense case of anorexia by my freshman year of high school. And it felt like the most isolating thing. I think I thought that, oh, you know, I'll go on one of these crazy diets you read about in a magazine, I'll lose a few pounds, and then I'll be good enough and I'll like myself more. And then what happened is I would go on a crazy diet. That's like a kid. Lose right. pounds, and then still not like myself and think, well, it must not have been enough. You need to lose more.
Yeah, it's like trying to find an external solution to an internal problem.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I didn't know that about your that you had an eating disorder. I mean, how do you do competitive sports and have an eating disorder? It seems like, you know, like nutrition is such a big thing when you're figure skating. You know, when you're doing those kind of things, it's like, how did you maintain that?
I didn't. I first started, I had figure skating was getting too intense, too competitive. So I stopped figure skating probably when I was around 13. And I missed the ice. I missed the skating part, but I did not miss the toxic energy and the way the women treated each other.
Yeah, I heard it's terrible.
I was happy to get away from that. And later, after my eating disorders healed, found ice hockey, which was a great outlet for me and a much healthier environment. But prior to that, I stopped skating competitively, still danced. And in dance, being thin is really a crown in glory. So I sure. got away with it for a really long time. And I don't know how I functioned. To tell you the honest truth, I really have no idea how I still got all A's in school. And that's, as I've come to learn, one of the hallmarks of eating disorders is that you can really become so controlling of all of your circumstances that it's very common for someone with an eating disorder to still get a 4.0 GPA and still get scholarships to university and still on the outside look like they have it all together. And that was me. I think I just put on a really good act until eventually, I have great parents, and eventually my parents caught on and doctors intervened and they're just like, sorry, you can't participate in any of these things until you learn to take care of yourself. So it came to an abrupt halt, truly.
Yeah.
And that was a big wake up call for me, because I think I would have tried to do those things forever.
But did you fight it, like, or did you just accept that, like, obviously that you were dealing with like the sickness and, you know, like you're trying to get back to health. Like, you know, for my story, I mean, I fought it. I didn't want to go to treatment center, you know, yeah. Like I didn't want to do the things. Did you fight it?
I did. I was convinced that I was the exception to the rule and that other people could eat normal meals and be fine. But if I did, I would gain 100 pounds. I really convinced myself of these things. I would fight it with every cell of my being because I had a terrible fear of losing control. And so I didn't want to get treatment at first because I'm sure there was an element of denial seeing other people, you know, weigh 90 pounds and they were fine, but that wasn't appropriate for my body. Yeah. And really just being afraid of what happens if I really let go and release all control here. And it was terrifying. So I definitely resisted it for a long time. And being a kid, thankfully, I had parents and teachers and doctors who put structures in place for me because I didn't know how to put them in place myself and say, well, you're going to therapy before school twice a week and you have to write down all the food that you're eating. And if you lie about it, we're going to know. And, you know, that's, it was a real confronting experience because I couldn't lie to myself. I couldn't lie to other people anymore. And I'm not somebody who ever thought of myself as a liar, but in this case, to protect this addiction, I really was. And I don't know if I ever articulated that before today, but yeah,
I mean, it's almost like omitting the truth.
Correct. Yeah. And it was terrifying to admit the truth. It was easier to live in denial and pretend that everything was fine and pretend that it looked fine. So for me, I did a lot of hanging out in denial, just hoping that things would remedy themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, those are hard realizations to come to.
I think I solved some of the problem in those early high school years, but not really the root problem, which was not learning how to love and accept myself as I was in the present moment, not learning how to be present. And I think that, yes, I was able to work with a therapist, put on weight. Of course, my metabolism was totally messed up. Sorry. So I ended up putting on too much weight and then hating myself on the other end of the spectrum. And I sort of went back and forth with that for years until I started doing yoga, dabbling in it when I was probably 18, 19, and a freshman at Boston University. And it was not very common then. This is like 1999, 2000. So to find a yoga class at a gym was really exciting. There weren't a lot of yoga studios around. And It was the first time I discovered yoga. And it was the only thing that made me feel quiet in my mind. It was the only thing that made me feel like I had a break from those negative self-talk types of thoughts. And
what age were you at this time?
I was just about 19 when I was playing around, going to yoga class at the gym, things like that. And
was it like a vinyasa flow class too? Or did you walk into an Ashtanga class?
I thought I walked into an Ashtanga class until eventually I really did Ashtanga later. I think many people have had that experience where it's called something, but it's not really the thing. And I tried hot yoga and I, you know, Bikram yoga was very nearby to me. So I went there and I had wonderful teachers, thankfully, in the beginning who really cared. I would go to vinyasa class at the gym. I'm from Boston originally. So Baron Baptiste had a school there and I would go to whatever was around, really. I knew enough to know that there were different styles of yoga that existed, but there wasn't really a format available in terms of finding one and taking it into an in-depth experience like you and I know now. So sure. It was kind of like yoga shopping. And I say that joyfully. It was a beautiful experience to have as a college student who was kind of looking to find herself. And it wasn't until I really started practicing yoga, even in that very undisciplined way, that I started to think, you know, maybe there's something better here. My mind feels better here. What if I can feel better more of the day? And I got really curious even though I had no idea how yoga worked or why it worked. But it was cool to go in.
Why do you think it piqued your interest like that? Just because of like how you felt calm?
I felt calm, and I actually was feeling little glimpses of feeling good about myself. And even though I had achieved a lot as a child, as a teenager, as a college student, I got a half tuition scholarship to Boston University, academic based. I'd achieved a lot of things. I did very well as a student, and I was a very responsible kid, but I don't think I ever really felt an inner level of contentment about who I was. And when I was doing yoga, it was the only time where I started to have little glimpses of saying, you know, I'm not so bad. And it was the first time I really had that experience that I could remember since being a very, very young child. So something about it made me go, why does this work? How does this work? Why am I feeling this here and not other places? Can I start to feel this more of the day? So that's really what piqued my curiosity, is I thought, if this can turn off my mind from thinking all the you're not good enough types of thoughts, this is really something. I wonder if it can help other people too.
Yeah, it's a pretty powerful experience. I mean, did you feel like you had a moment where it came to that? Or did you actually feel like it was over a course of, you know, like a year? Or like, when did the epiphany come?
The epiphany probably came a couple of years later, to be honest. I had been dabbling around in yoga and really enjoying it, but it wasn't my only mode of exercise. It wasn't a disciplined practice at that time, the way I know it now. And I think I was 20 when I was in a really rigorous program in school. 9/11 had just happened. And I think I was telling myself that I was fine, even though friends of mine had lost their parents. And it was really intense time to be alive. And I started having panic attacks, and I didn't know what they were. And I thought I was dying. And I went to my pediatrician, who I'd seen my whole life because I didn't know what else to do. And she said, you know, tell me, what are you doing in school? What's your life like? So I gave her the rundown. And she said, you know, that yoga thing that you're doing that you go to sometimes, why don't you tell me more about that? So I told her where I went and what I did. And she said, you know, Sarah, Christmas break is coming up. I'm not convinced that taking anxiety meds is the best avenue for you. Why don't you just commit to going to yoga a lot over Christmas break? You have nothing else to do. You'll have a break from your schoolwork. And then let's have an appointment at the end of Christmas break and we'll see how you feel. And in university, of course, Christmas break is a long time, at least a month. So I thought, all right, I'll do that. And the deep breathing gave me tools to manage my anxiety. It made my mind feel even more quiet, which at that juncture in my life was so necessary that I left that Christmas break feeling like a different person. And my parents didn't know what yoga was at that time when I was going to yoga every day. And they probably were wondering if I was in a cult. Eventually they asked me that. And they also sort of said, you know, we don't really care if you're in a cult because you seem so much happier that if this is what you need to do, go do it. But whatever you're doing, it's working for you. You seem more relaxed. You seem more at peace with yourself. Go keep doing this thing. So that was when it really hit me that there's a lot more here than just going to yoga once in a while to get a nice stretch or to, you know, get the yoga butt that magazines talk about. And
yoga butt is no butt. That's what yoga butt is.
I disagree. I actually think it has made my butt much more strong and shapely. I come from a family with no butts. But yeah, yoga was just a vanity thing, I think, in the beginning. And then after that Christmas break, when I was 20 years old, I thought, no, there's way more here. And I want to learn about it. So I started buying some books. And I started going to more classes. And I started reading about the different kinds of yoga. And I started getting curious around what meditation was. And a year after that, I was a senior in college. I heard David Swensen was coming to town. And I took a week off of my second semester of my senior year to go do one of his 40-hour programs, thinking I had experienced Ashtanga already. Turns out I hadn't. That was a fun thing to find out at David's 40-hour workshop, by the way.
Yeah, it seems like very a really poor. Tough thing to find out too.
But he was so non-judgmental and loving and just so wonderful to be around. And I was so excited to really learn what Ashtanga was, that he was so embracing to me. He didn't care that I had learned the wrong way, you know, and I see that with students now. It's not their fault. They're just being good students, you know, doing what they're told. And who knows what the teacher tells them to do if it's not what they promised to. But he was so devoted in his leadership and really, I think, saw something in me that had a lot of excitement for the practice and spent a lot of time with me in that week showing me how it worked. And he taught a beautiful in-depth experience to all of us who were there. And I was never the same after that. After that, I practiced in my dorm room alone with his book because apps did not exist yet at that point. And I was really committed to my daily practice, even though I didn't have a teacher with me all the time. So that was when I was really connecting to Ashtanga as my method. I was 21, 22.
Wow.
Yeah, it was the start of what is still my practice now.
Yeah.
Years later.
And so, you know, in those like kind of formative years of learning Ashtanga, like, you know, what kind of benefits do you feel like you were getting out of it?
I think the best way to describe it is I felt a different sense of aliveness. After practice would be over, even though I wasn't in a Mysore room, and now whenever I am, I'm like, God, this is such a gift to be here with other people and a brilliant teacher in person. It taught me a lot of discipline about taking care of myself. I think that prior to that, I'd always look for some external thing to either fix me or make me feel good. And certainly had my fair share of experimenting with drugs and alcohol and all that, though I never formed a habit with it. I was looking for something. I was looking for something to fill the void, to make me feel better. And when I started practicing daily, even in my college dorm room, I felt that sense of aliveness within me. I didn't feel like I had to go find something on the outside to do it for me. That was a marked difference compared to even the other types of yoga that I had tried. They were good workouts. I liked them. They were fun. They were sometimes entertaining, but it didn't feel that same sense of fulfillment within that Ashtanga brought me. And that's really what started to happen for me. And it only made me want to practice more. It only made me want to learn more about it. It was kind of the start of my honeymoon phase of yoga, where like it's never enough. You just want to dive in more and more. Right. But I had never known that I could feel that way. And I was excited to know that it was possible for me to feel such deep levels of contentment. And it only blossomed from there as I felt better within myself. My body changed for the better. I became stronger. I became healthier at the weight that I was. I had better thoughts about myself. And I really attribute this all to my practice, bringing me
wow.
peace from within.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I mean, so how did you make it to Mysore on your first time?
Oh, like, this is
when did you go first, and like how did you even make it there?
I was 24 years old, so a couple of years after college, and I met my husband, Ben, when I was at Boston University. He was a year ahead of me, so he had moved to Long Island. And when I would go visit him while I was finishing school still, we would hop around to different yoga studios and find classes to take. And I found a studio that felt like home to me at that time. And they didn't have a Mysore program or anything, but the teachers were Ashtanga practitioners, so we would all get together and practice when I eventually moved there. And I'd been living there for about 6 months when the owner of the studio said, "Hey, can you watch the studio for me? I'm going to go to Mysore for the first time." So I kind of watched her go and have this really profound experience and come back. And then she said, "Next time I go, you're going to come." And I was kind of like, okay, you know, I took it with a grain of salt. I didn't think I had a strong desire to go. And then the more she talked about it, the more curious I got. So I was 24 years old and she said, "I'm going again book your ticket. Let's go together. And so I really credit her. Her name is Stacey Plasky. She still lives in Long Island. And she was a wonderful guide for me, and just in terms of back in the day when you couldn't find an apartment on Facebook, because I wasn't even on Facebook yet. She really was so wonderful in just showing me the way of how to book your car and how to get there and what practice looks like. And the craziest thing is that my very first ever Mysore class as a student was at the Shala in Mysore.
That's crazy.
Crazy, right? I had never done back bending with anyone other than one of my friends helping me. And with us, it was kind of like the blind leading the blind. But I'm so glad that I wasn't intimidated. I'm so glad that I hadn't, you know, talked to too many people who'd gone, because I totally would have intimidated myself into not going and feeling like, oh, I have to learn more before I go. But I was just young and bright-eyed and thought, hey, I don't have kids yet. I don't have a house yet. It's time for me to go and do this. And I think that was my attitude. I thought I would go, get it out of my system, and then come home and, you know, quote, be responsible, end quote. And what all that happened is it got into my system, and 10 trips later, here I am.
Wow. And what did you get out of that first experience?
It was the first time I was in a completely different place. I had traveled and studied in Europe in college and things like that, but I had never been a place like India. And you know, there's no place like India.
There's no place like India at all.
And it's just going to show you all those parts of yourself that need cleaning up. I know you're a big fan of cleanup work, Taylor.
Right.
And that's what it was to me. It was like, oh, all those habits that you wanted to clean up, here they are. You have no excuses now. You're alone. You're far away. Clean them up. And that combined with the practice every day and the deep levels of learning I was experiencing, just, it's impossible to articulate what it felt like, but it felt like a deeper connection with myself. It felt like I got to know myself away from my parents, away from my partner, away from an institution like school. And I really just got to see me. Of who I was that first time. And oh God, was I sore. It was intense. But it was beautiful. And really, it felt like an intensive in terms of really seeing myself for the first time. And it was beautiful and eye-opening and intense and wonderful all at once. And it was just a crash course in non-attachment. I think my first trip, I landed, but my bags didn't make my connecting flight. So it took probably 3 or 4 days for them to arrive. So I had no clothes. You know, my first few practices, I was wearing my friend's clothes because hers had arrived and she's like 6 inches taller than me. And none of it mattered. Like, it just didn't matter. You just showed up as you were with a full heart, ready to learn. And it was profound that when you strip away all the external things, it was still so powerful.
Yeah, that's, I mean, for me, it's like even basically more of a transformative experience, because it's like everything is just dropped away.
Totally. Totally. And all the excuses that you put up, you know, when you're home and you have a lot of responsibilities and whatnot, you just don't have them over there in the same way. So it really strips things down to who are you? What do you really need to thrive? What do you really need to clean up and get rid of? Now go do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. And so you've been back 10 times.
Yeah. Cool. Been back 10 times.
And do you feel like you get the kind of the same sort of recharge that you got even the first time?
I think I get more now. Especially because I'm a parent now. So when I go to India, typically I go alone without my husband and children, which was never my plan, by the way. I had visions of all of us going together and having this lovely experience. And I see you there with your kids, Taylor, and that's the experience I wanted. That's the experience I thought I was going to have. But my eldest child has special needs. He's on the autism spectrum, and India just does not yet have the resources for him to thrive. So when the kids were really little and Ben and I were having this conversation, he just said, listen, either you go back by yourself or not at all, at least for now. This is the decision you have to make. So I went alone and I was really terrified and I cried a lot the first week. And it became even more important to me to go there and recharge myself, refocus on myself, because my life at home as a business owner, as a special needs mom, as a spouse, was so much more demanding than it was when I was a bright-eyed 24-year-old going to just explore. And now I feel like I go there and I just get my head on straight. And I, you know, in the practice, am seeing new sides of myself that I didn't know were there, that I didn't know I was capable of. So whenever I come home, I feel like, you know, bring it, universe. I can handle whatever you're going to throw at me. And it's so much more empowering for me now that even though my trips tend to be a little shorter, more like a month, I am so deeply thankful for them. And I've actually made a lot of progress in my short but consistent trips, more than I have in some of my long trips that were 3 months and beyond. So I have learned a lot of lessons from this. And yeah, I feel like it's more important for me than ever. And I'm sure in some ways you feel that way too.
Yeah, totally. I obviously I have the opposite experience. Like I got like five people there.
And like an hour of sleep a night.
Yeah. I mean, seriously, because no one sleeps at least the first week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, will you continue to go back?
Totally. I can't wait to go back. I'm definitely ready. I'm definitely feeling the itch to go back. And I think for me, I've had the gift actually of being a really devoted home practitioner. I didn't start in a shala. I didn't start with a teacher with me every day. So it was up to me in the very beginning to build that discipline of go to India, learn your lessons, take them home and apply them and be devoted. So I've had many, many years, thankfully, of being devoted by myself, but it makes those trips even more important, especially now that I'm much further into advanced A than I ever thought I would get. I know you are as well. And I remember my first trip to India, I didn't know what advanced A or third series even was. And I remember seeing someone doing deep back bending and catching, thinking, I'll never do that. You know, I had no idea what it was. And now that I'm doing these things, which I jokingly called no man's land for so long because I'd never had seen them and I'd never felt them, now that I'm doing them for myself, I feel like it's even more important to go back and get the guidance that I need so that I'm not flying blind physically or mentally or emotionally with what happens now.
Do you think like going to Mysore has helped you become a better mother?
Oh, definitely. I think on a purely kind of learning level, seeing the way families are in India and seeing the devotion that exists between generations, helping each other and supporting each other was really important for me to see, because I think in the United States, it's so easy to see people growing up and all going their own way. And it really taught me to embrace however the generations of my family can show up and love each other, and whatever role my parents want to play in my kids' lives. I think that's really important and special, even if it's not perfect, even if it's not the way other families do it, because I really want there to be that connection. And it's helped me to do that and, you know, to put my ego aside and my snottiness aside and just do it. And I'm thankful that I've had that influence. I also think it's taught me a lot more patience. As you know, there are things in India that require a lot of patience. And it's really taught me to just not rush, not worry that things are going to be perfect. And especially in my situation, I can't put that pressure on myself. I can't put that pressure on my son. And it's really helped me to just know that our path may not be linear. It may not be fast, as you know, nothing about India is linear to me. And yet you always get where you need to be. And I've really taken that mentality into parenting. We're always going to get where we need to be. I don't need to white knuckle this experience.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty awesome too. That's awesome. Well, let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about like what you're doing nowadays, you know, because I think it's really interesting. Like, you know, obviously I'm watching from afar, but you know, you got a podcast going on. I saw a virtual retreat. I mean, I've seen, you know, that you actually do in-person retreats, just not this year or not right now, at least. You know, you don't necessarily have a Mysore program that you do on a consistent basis, but your business model is basically much different than mine. And so why don't you tell like the listeners a little bit about like what kind of stuff you're doing?
Sure. I had a Mysore program for 4 years and I loved it. And I had beautiful students. And as I mentioned before, being a special needs mom was never really on my agenda, but nonetheless, now that it's here, it's a role that I take really seriously. And I just found that I always loved working with students one-on-one, just like I work with my son one-on-one. And it really called to me. It also provided a framework for me to be a lot more present for my family, which at this juncture in my life was really needed. And I'm sure at some point that may change. But it was time for me at the end of 2016 to shift gears. So now I work with many students one-on-one. I also mentor yoga teachers in growing sustainable businesses for themselves, because I think so many yoga teachers are so brilliant and they're experts truly, and they're still not charging appropriately for their services. They're still not prioritizing their own well-being and their own lifestyle because they're so focused on giving. So I do both. I teach yoga and I mentor yoga teachers in becoming more profitable and sustainable in how they work. And I really love both.
How did you get into that?
I went to school for business. I was, you know, going to go work on Wall Street, Taylor. That was the plan. Wall Street or law school was the plan. And obviously yoga came in and interrupted that plan. Thank God. But there was always part of me that still really found the business side of things stimulating. And even when I was running my Mysore program, I always enjoyed that entrepreneurial piece, and it was just fun for me. So as I started building up my one-on-one client base, that type of work called to me even more. And I ended up having a lot of students in my one-on-one practice who were yoga teachers, because there wasn't a lot of resources for more advanced practitioners to go to a Mysore room, at least where I live. And they came to me looking for help in their asana practice. But inevitably, down the line, they would say, oh, hey, I have my ladies' holiday today, but can I still have my session? And can we talk about this challenge I'm having with students or with the studio that I'm working at? And so it sort of evolved organically about 3 years ago. And I found it to be so exciting for me to see that I was able to help yoga teachers who I really loved and respected thrive in their lives. And that's how it grew. And then eventually it became a little bit bigger and it became something that I felt comfortable sharing. And that took some time for me, but eventually I started a podcast, Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Wellness Professional. And we're breaking down basic business things that people, even in the wellness arena, need to know about in order to thrive, because you can't help anyone if you're suffering. And that's really what I've told teachers do.
Especially financially suffering. It's like, you know, I feel like yoga teachers can, you know, could really use a lot of those tools, and partially because they're not really business people. You know, they're not people like yourself. You know, they tend to be a little bit more creative. They tend to be a little bit more like, you know, like not good at paying bills and good at the marketing side, but not good at, you know, so how to manage people, where it's like, I just, you know, so there's so many aspects of business that, you know, I think are really important, like really important to talk about, because I mean, that's why yoga businesses go out of business.
100%. And we're seeing that now more than ever. There's going to be a lot of studios that don't come back after COVID. And it's a shame, because it doesn't mean their teachers are poor teachers in the way of knowledge. But if you don't know how to function as a thriving business, eventually you're going to have to opt out. You're going to burn out. You're going to get too tired. And whenever I see that happen to a yoga teacher who I respect, it always makes me sad. And I always feel like just taking them and saying, it doesn't have to be that way. You can help tons of people and you can also thrive yourself. And I think the important thing to remember is that I didn't become a yoga teacher because I loved business so much. I became a yoga teacher because I thought I was getting away from the business world. And people become yoga teachers because they've been healed They want to help and heal others. And that's amazing. But at some point, unless you're living under a rock or you're still living with mom and dad at age 40, you're going to have to figure out how to do this in a way that's sustainable. And I see a lot of people doing it in a way that's not sustainable. And I'm curious to see how that changes after people get back in their studios more and more and life starts to resume with in-person connection. Because I think, and I feel very strongly that I have become a solid yoga practitioner because I've shown up on my mat day after day and done it, even when I've not done it perfectly, even when it's felt hard. And running a business is the same way. Just show up and learn something every day, and you have to practice it. You're not going to be born a good business person. It's not like someone gives you a certificate and says, you're a business person now. You have to just chip away at it. And that's really my goal with my podcast and how I work with people, is just showing them, like, show up imperfectly, do what you can today, and stay on the path.
And do you think that your yoga practice has helped you kind of get into, because what you're describing to me is sort of like you fell into your dharma, like how you were supposed to like serve other people.
Yeah. You know, like I said, I thought I was getting away from the business world, and the joke was on me because it sort of found me in a different way than I never imagined. And I'm glad. I really am. And it's been a journey myself. I have a mentor in business because I have a mentor in my practice. Why wouldn't I have a mentor in my business too? There are things that I have to keep learning about. So I practice what I preach, and I am now really opting out of the mentality that you have to do everything alone. And I think India has influenced me in this way too. You see communities, you know, living together and depending on each other, and families depending on all generations to function and be well. And I realized that in my life at some point, I felt like I was doing everything alone. I was running my Mysore program alone. I was only getting to India once a year. I was, you know, the mom is the glue of the family. So I felt like, even though my husband's a great dad, like, it was a lot of pressure to parent day after day. And I just felt like, I'm done doing things alone. I need support. And that's when I went and found myself a mentor in my business, which of course has influenced my whole life. And it was a big leap for me, but it's really shown me a lot about how to merge the two things I really love, yoga and business, and show people that it is possible to do both, and to do both with integrity and be in alignment with who you are and not compromise what you believe in. You can have all those things.
Yeah. Do you still practice for the same reason as why you started?
100%. Every day. And, you know, I'm sure my husband won't mind me saying this, but he recently started having anxiety attacks, and he's opening up a whole new business, and he's got his own levels of stress. But it was funny because he looked at me the other day and he said, so this must be how you felt when you were in your early 20s and you were motivated to wake up every day and get on your mat. And I said, yep. And I said, and I still feel the exact same way. And he said, so it wasn't so much that you were just a crazy disciplined person. It was that you really needed this to function as your medicine. And I said, yep, same is true now.
It's like out of suffering, you know, like actions change.
Yes.
You know? So yeah, it's pretty powerful testament right there.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for being on the show and sharing your heart and sharing some of the things that you're doing. You know, like, what an amazing story. It's like, you know, from where you were to where you're at now, it's just like, you know, it's really powerful. So, you know, I know a lot of the women, or at least some of the women that are practicing with us at AYC, have struggled with eating disorders as well. And that perfection thing is there. And, you know, a lot of the things that you described, is there. And so I appreciate you talking on the subject, but, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hey guys, thanks for tuning in. If you want more information about Ashtanga Yoga, visit ashtangayogacolumbus.com. You can also check out my website, which is taylorhuntyoga.com. See you guys next time.